This is Dolores Cannon again with the Metaphysical Hour. And we're on the air again with another guest tonight. At first, when I started doing these shows, I was wondering if anybody was listening, because I sit here in my office and talk to the wall. But now I know they are, because I'm getting wonderful emails from everyone, even as far away as Russia and New Zealand, that say they are listening to this show. So maybe it is all worthwhile after all. But before we do my guest, I want to remind everyone about the conference that's coming up. My publishing company, Ozark Mountain Publishing, is putting on its first conference called the Transformation Conference. It's going to be held in Fayetteville, Arkansas, on June the 3rd and the 4th, which would be next weekend. And we're doing it mostly to showcase a lot of our authors. And we have some very wonderful people that are going to be speakers. And I've been interviewing a lot of these during the last month. And the one we have tonight will be my guest, is our keynote speaker, Arun Gandhi. And he is the grandson of Mahatma Gandhi. And our publishing house published his book several years ago. It's called The Forgotten Woman. And it's the story, the biography of his grandmother. And it is a very fascinating story. I think I know more about the Gandhi family than the average person, because I had to edit that book. So I have a little bit of more knowledge, I guess, than the average ones out there. But, okay, Arun, you're there, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
It's been about almost 10 years ago, I think, that we first met.
Yes, it's been many years.
It was in the ARE was having a Easter, I think it was the Sunrise Easter Conference out in Virginia Beach.
Right, that's right.
And you were the speaker, the main speaker, and I was there, and I think that's where we first met.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Quite a while ago.
Yeah, many years ago.
Yes, it's surprising whenever you think of it.
Yes.
But I remember the time you were talking to me that you had been trying for a long time to find a publisher for your book, and people just wouldn't look at it.
Yes, unfortunately, everybody kept saying that I should write about my grandfather, but nobody was interested in the story of my grandmother.
Yes, but
and
there is
felt
quite
very
a story
about
there.
That.
It is a forgotten woman, because it's a story that people really don't know.
Yeah.
What did you call her, the mother of India?
Yeah.
The woman who unified the women of India.
Yes.
And, you know, there's always a woman behind every famous man.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe you said you spent 30 years researching that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I was, of course, working at that time as a journalist, and so I couldn't devote a lot of time to researching. So whenever I had some free time or free holidays or something, I would work on that research.
Mm-hmm.
My wife helped me a lot in doing the research, too.
Yes, uh-huh. Sananda.
Yeah. And so we finally got enough material to be able to write a book of.
I remember you saying that you were going and interviewing all the people you could find who were still alive that remembered your grandparents.
Right. You know, because not much had been written about her by anybody except grandfather, whenever he made a reference to her in his biography, autobiography.
Uh-huh.
Apart from that, there was not much written about her, so we had to depend a lot on memory of people who had lived with her and worked with her. And we kind of pieced together all of these interviews from various people. And it was particularly difficult because all of them were so enamored by grandfather.
Uh-huh.
That, you know, they would start off talking about grandmother, and very soon they would start talking about grandfather, and I had to keep reminding them that I was more interested in grandmother than in grandfather.
he's such an important figure that everybody else is more or less in his shadow.
Right.
It's difficult.
Very difficult.
But I remember you did say that you found a box of very old letters in the ashram in South Africa, didn't you?
Yes, I did. My parents had preserved all these letters for sentimental reasons. And after my mother died, my father had died much earlier, and my mother died in 1988.
Uh-huh.
And I got those letters from her before she died. And those were very valuable, too.
Yeah, those filled in a lot of the missing pieces, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Mm-hmm. Because I was amazed when I was doing the editing on the book. That's where I found out a lot about Gandhi and your grandmother that I never knew before, and I don't imagine a lot of people didn't know about this.
Mm.
You know, when they made the movie, I think the movie is only a very small part of his life.
Yes, indeed.
Because that started much later.
Uh-huh. Yes, his life was very full, and I think if they tried to make a movie of his entire life, it would go into probably two full movies or something.
I believe so.
Yeah.
Because one thing I think people didn't realize, that at the height of his career as a lawyer in South Africa, they were very rich, weren't they?
Yes, he was. He was very rich. He was earning a phenomenal amount as a lawyer. I believe his practice had grown to something like 65,000 to 70,000 pounds a year in
uh-huh.
those days in the 1800s. That was a lot of money.
So he was very successful and very rich.
Yeah, because he was then the only Indian lawyer in the whole country. In the whole of South Africa.
Oh, the entire country.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of business.
So he had tremendous amount of business.
One thing I thought was interesting in the book was that when he first became a lawyer, the very first case he tried, he said he couldn't even speak.
Yes, he tried to set up a practice in India.
Uh-huh.
And he got a couple of clients, and when he went to court to defend them, he couldn't get up and speak. He was so tongue-tied. And he had to refund their fees and walk out in disgrace from there. And he reached a point when he felt that he wouldn't be able to do any legal practice at all. And he was, in fact, looking for a job as a teacher, high school teacher.
Uh-huh.
And he was refused a job by the British administration because they didn't recognize the matriculation that he had done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in spite of his having a law degree from England, they were very particular about the matriculation, so they refused
uh-huh.
him permission to teach.
I think that ought to make people realize that people don't just start off full-blown, you know, as
right.
a success.
Yeah, you know, people also need to realize that he was a very simple, ordinary man with all the same weaknesses that all of us have.
Yeah, because how many people are afraid to get up and speak before people?
Right.
And it showed that he started out with the same fears that the rest of us had.
Mm-hmm.
He had to overcome a lot.
He had to, yes, overcome a lot of things.
You know, I found an article I was going to send to you that I found in a newspaper. It's been a few years ago. I should have sent it to you by now. But there were a lot of people that kept saying there was no proof that your grandfather ever attended the law school. I think it was London, wasn't it?
Yes, in London, yeah.
And they kept saying there was no proof of that. Well, I saw this article where as they were going through some real old records that they were going to throw out, they finally found papers
uh-huh.
that did prove that he did go to school there.
Yes.
So that ought to quiet a lot of the skeptics.
Right.
The ones that are always trying to pull people down.
People, you know, in these days, they're always looking for sensationalism.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing sells a lot. So, you know, sensationalizing things has become a habit with people now.
Yeah. But the reason I brought it up about your grandfather being very rich at one time was that that's why it was very difficult on your grandmother when
yes.
he suddenly decided he's going to change his entire life.
Right. And he practically decided this overnight. He was coming from Johannesburg back to Durban where the family was living. And at the Johannesburg station, English Jewish friend of his, Henry Pollack, gave him a little booklet called Unto This Last by John Ruskin.
Yeah.
And, he started reading this in the train, and he says he just couldn't put it down. It was all about the effects of materialism and how it corrupts our life and, how we need to simplify our livings and, lives and all that. And he just read all through the night, and by the next morning he was convinced that what John Ruskin was saying was right. And so he decided that he was going to give up everything and simplify his life and live on the farm.
That's quite a decision from somebody who in that kind, of a position of
right.
wealth like that.
Right. So he just kind of, in a flash, he gave up all his wealth and practice. And
that had a big effect on him.
It had tremendous effect on him.
But I remember from your book, Castoval was not happy at all. Your grandmother,
she wasn't. she was thinking more in practical terms. She had four boys. They had to be married, and they were, she wanted to get things for their wives and
yeah.
so on, And I think women are more they're more concerned about security. And so she was, fearful that you give up everything, what are we going to live on? And how are we going to manage?
She had servants. She had a big house.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite a decision. You have to really love someone if you're going to turn your entire life around.
Yeah.
But I know they were married since they were children.
Yeah, they married at the age of 13.
Yeah.
And, that was quite normal in those days.
Uh-huh. Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe, didn't you say that your grandmother for many years had a difficulty with switching to that way of life?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she always had this difficulty because, she came from a very different family. She was also a very strong woman, strong-minded woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to be convinced about everything before she would submit to it.
Uh-huh.
She was not one of those, a lot of people thought that she was... a quiet follower, she just did whatever her husband told her to do.
Yeah.
She was not that at all. She was a very determined, very firm-minded person who wanted to be convinced about everything before she agreed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And this giving up wealth was something that was very difficult for her to accept. It took a lot of effort to convince her eventually.
Yeah. Also, I remember from the book that her sons had a lot of difficulty with Gandhi also.
Yeah, especially the older son. The oldest one, the firstborn, had many difficulties. And I think what really happened was that he stayed in India with... Gandhi's older brothers and their families.
Yeah.
When grandfather was studying in England, and then when he came to South Africa, this boy grew up in that family. And I'm sure, these problems that grandfather was facing with having to start a practice, and that was quite a severe problem because the family had taken a lot of loans for his education in England.
Yeah.
And they had to pay back all that money, and they were counting on him coming back and having a lucrative practice and earning money and paying the loans back. But he was finding it very difficult. And so I'm pretty sure that these older brothers may have been talking derisively about him at home and taunting him for not being able to do anything. And,
mm-hmm.
and that must have affected this boy.
Yeah. Because I remember was one of them wanted to go on and have further education.
Yeah, he was the one who wanted to go and have further education.
And that
and then there was this whole thing about the man in South Africa, a merchant, who offered a scholarship. Gandhi, my grandfather, was put in charge of finding the right student to to
mm-hmm.
win the scholarship to go to England and study.
Yes.
And so what he did was he launched an essay competition, and everybody submitted their essays, and he went through all of them, and the final two people who came up for the final, one of them was his son, and the other was the son of another friend.
Mm-hmm. So they competed fairly anyway.
So everybody felt that his son had done a better job, but grandfather decided to give the scholarship to the other boy.
Yeah, he was afraid.
Because he was afraid that everybody would say, naturally he's going to select his own son.
Yeah, that he would be favoring him.
Yeah, and he would be accused of nepotism and so on, and he didn't want to open himself for that kind of thing. And so he awarded the scholarship to the other boy, and that really hurt this boy considerably. And so, with all
the
background
of
the...
It affected him the rest of his life,
didn't it? Sorry?
It affected him the rest of his life.
Yeah, well, he then just went down the drain. After that, he became an alcoholic. And
yeah, that's the one. That
he
became
walked
an
out
alcoholic.
Of the house, and, he gave up the family. And he just ruined his own life after that.
See, there are a lot of people that don't know those things, that Gandhi's children, his family, were not perfect by any means.
Yeah.
Everybody had their own problems.
Mm-hmm.
Living with someone like that, I believe, it would be very difficult anyway.
Yeah, my father, who was the closest to him, he had devoted his time to working for nonviolence in South Africa after grandfather went back to India.
Mm-hmm.
He had a hard time doing that because, he was constantly under scrutiny from India.
Mm-hmm.
And every little thing that he did, grandfather would scrutinize that, and he had to be always on his toes.
Well,
so,
your father was the one
couldn't...
who founded the ashram in South Africa, didn't he?
Grandfather started the ashram, yeah.
Okay, but your father is the one that continued it?
He continued working there, and while all the rest of the family went back with grandfather, my father remained and continued working there.
And that's where you were born, wasn't
that's
it?
That's where
in
I
South
was born.
South Africa?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it wasn't easy for him to work there, being under the scrutiny of... his father all the time was very difficult.
Yeah, because
and I can understand his father's concerns too, because this philosophy was so new that he himself was still discovering many aspects of it. And so he just didn't want anybody else, including his own family, kind of go astray or misinterpret the philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So, one can understand that kind of feelings too.
Yes, in retrospect, you know, you can understand the whole family was more or less under a magnifying glass. Everybody wants to watch every move.
Right.
Just like any celebrity today.
Exactly.
But when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't make it any easier.
Mm.
That's the problem. You know, you can look at it afterwards and understand it.
Mm.
But do you want to tell us about your life then, if you were born at the ashram, weren't you?
Yes, I was born in the ashram in Phoenix, and we grew up there, my two sisters and I. And when we were growing up, by then, you know, since much of the family and people who were living in the ashram with grandfather, they went away to India, there were not many people left in the ashram.
They kind of dwindled, you mean?
Yeah. And you know, it was quite lonely, but and everything had to be done by us with the help of two families that continued to live there.
Mm-hmm.
It was very hard life because my father was asked if, you know, he was told by his father that if you want to live here and do this work, then you will have to accept voluntary poverty. You can't live a normal life and earn money and so on.
Mm.
And my father agreed to that. So we were, our livelihood and our income all depended on what people gave to the institution.
And that's hard to live like that.
Yeah, it was very hard. And I remember as a young boy growing up, my father was bringing out a weekly newspaper, which was also started by grandfather.
Yeah.
And he was bringing that out, and we were trying to sell that because that was the way of communicating with the entire community and showing them the nonviolent approach.
Yeah.
You know, educating them in the philosophy of nonviolence. And so, I had to go out from door to door collecting subscriptions for this.
Uh-huh. That was
when I was a
teenager. Make a living.
Yeah. And many of these people would tell me on my face, you know, he says, we don't even read your paper, and they would show me all these papers stacked up in the corner. They didn't even bother to open the wrappers of it.
Oh.
And they, you know, would make such nasty remarks and say that we are living on charity and, you know, all that kind of thing. And it really pained me a lot.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I decided that if I grow up and if I'm going to do this work, I am going to keep my livelihood apart from this work so that I don't want anybody to ever say to me or to my family and my children that we are living on charity,
mm-hmm.
as we were told when we were growing up, you know, constantly.
But did you also have a lot of other problems living down there?
Yeah, the other usual problems because of the apartheid and the discrimination there. We were constantly, judged by the color of our skin. I was beaten up a couple of times by white people and then by black people. And it was a very hard time. And, on reflection now, it amazes me that a whole society was brought up in so much hate.
Yeah.
Everybody was hating everybody else. And
I think you said you felt in the middle because you weren't white and you weren't black.
Right, yeah. So I wasn't accepted by the blacks, I wasn't accepted by the whites. And, it was a very strange kind of life.
But wasn't it your family was worried that you were going to be, become angry and violent yourself?
Yeah, they were, because after the two experiences that I had of physical beatings, it became an obsession with me. I wanted to be able to strike back again and be violent with people who were violent with me.
Yeah, it's a natural thing to do.
Yeah. So
even for a young boy, here you're in this kind of a position.
Right.
You want.
So I was getting very angry and frustrated, and they saw this and so they decided that it was time to go to India and stay with grandfather and hopefully be able to overcome this problem.
Mm-hmm. So they thought that going to live with your grandfather, he could help you then.
Yeah.
To get away from those tendencies.
Right. Mm-hmm. That he would help me overcome the anger and teach me how to deal with
resentment and everything.
Yeah.
Arun, what do you think would have happened if you would have stayed in South Africa? If you were to look back on it now, what do you think your life would have been like?
Well, I think, judging from my friends who grew up with me,
yeah,
and their lives now, they seem to have wasted their lives, achieved nothing.
Mm.
And I think I would have been just like them.
Yeah, because you would have been in that kind of situation.
I don't think I would have been able to achieve anything. If I had followed the family tradition and opposed apartheid, I would have spent much of my time in prison.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know what that would have affected, how that would have affected me.
I tell people they come to crossroads in their lives.
Mm.
When you can go different directions.
Yeah.
And if you would have gone the other direction, their lives would have been totally different.
Mm-hmm.
But so they have to make a decision. So this was like one of the crossroads in your life.
Yes. Yes. Especially, as I said, when growing up as a young teenager, I was victim of not only the prejudices in the larger society, but the snide remarks of people in our own society who kept telling me that we were living on charity and being very nasty towards me.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I wouldn't have accepted the way my father lived, and I would have wanted to break away from that. And
it would have been natural to rebel, and might end up in gangs or anything.
Yeah.
So I
shudder sometimes to think what would have happened to me if I had continued to live there.
Yeah. We do know, too, that the ashram was burned later, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But that was many years later, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was burnt in 1985.
So that would have been long after you had been out of there anyway.
Yeah.
But so when you went to India, were you still defiant, so to speak, whenever you first went to live with your grandfather?
I was still defiant.
Were you? Were you still angry?
I was, when I went to live with grandfather, I was still very angry.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
But having lived with grandfather, and he taught me about how to deal with that anger.
Uh-huh.
And then I began to understand what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so
that was a very important time in your life then.
Yeah. And he taught me also that he said, if you really feel so angry about what's happening and the discrimination and all that, then why don't you do something to change that?
Yeah.
And so I thought that was a good suggestion, that I should use my life to bring about a change and make people aware that this kind of prejudice is not right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's how I've gotten into the work that I'm doing now.
Well, how many years did you live with your grandfather?
I was with him for about 18 months.
Oh, that wasn't very, very long, but it was enough to make a difference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was enough to make a difference in my life.
Uh-huh. Well, you weren't.
And, you know, this
too.
Is something very strange. You know, you can be with a person for one day and it can affect you, or you can live with that person your whole life and not be affected.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, look at what happened to your grandfather just on that one night on the train. Just one thing
right.
can make a big difference.
Yeah. One night on the train made a difference to his life.
And the 18 months with your grandfather helped you to mold your entire life after that.
Yeah.
So it was important. But you weren't with him whenever he was assassinated. You weren't living there at that time.
No, we had just gone back to South Africa.
You went back to the ashram.
We had been in India for almost 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And the ashram and the weekly paper and all that was left in the charge of a friend, and he was getting impatient and wanted to go back and do his own, pursue his own life. And so he wrote to my father and said, I'm going back now. You better come here and take over.
Yeah.
So by November of 1947, just after India became independent.
Oh, that was when it happened.
Yeah, India became independent on the 15th of August, 1947. So after that, we all went back to South Africa. And
then
grandfather was assassinated 2 months later.
That's what I was thinking. It was in 1948, wasn't it?
Yeah, 30th of January, 1948.
Uh-huh. So it was right after you had left then.
Yeah. And that was quite a shock to us.
But, you know, as you write the book and everything, you look back on it, do you think he accomplished everything that he could have accomplished in life?
I don't think he had accomplished everything that he wanted to accomplish. You know, whenever we would talk about this during his life, he would say he wanted to live for 125 years because he had so much to do, and he wanted to, he would need 125 years to accomplish all that.
But, you know, if you look at it with history, he was there during the most earth-changing things, I guess you would call it.
Right.
So it might have been time for him to leave. Whenever you look at history from a bigger picture.
Right.
But I know there was a lot later that there was a lot of problems in that part of the world that I don't know if he could have helped it or not. It's hard to say. The things that happened
difficult.
Later.
I think, you know, the whole tragedy was that the Indian government, the Indian leadership that took over the government of India, they decided to abandon his philosophy and abandon the advice he had given for India's development and the way they should go about it. And they chose to use the Western model of development and capital-intensive development and so on. And they didn't accept any part of his philosophy at all. We face all these problems. You know, he was against, for instance, the division of the country.
Yeah.
He didn't want India to be divided into India and Pakistan.
Yeah.
He said everybody, has a right to this country, whether they are Hindus or Muslims. They were born here, and this is their country, and the country doesn't need to be divided.
Yeah, and it's been having problems ever since.
Yeah, and these politicians, they were so impatient to get into seats of power that they ignored his advice and they went and accepted partition from the British. And the consequence of that is that we're suffering still 60 years after the event.
Yes, it's still having problems over there, and they're sitting on the edge of nuclear war.
Right.
It just keeps getting worse.
India would have been a very different country today if they had followed Gandhi's advice.
But, you know, we always have free will. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's the problem.
So let's talk about you then. When you decided then you were going to, what, follow your grandfather's way of thinking?
Well, not entirely, but
I think... Tell about what happened to you then, what put you on your path.
Well, as you said, there comes a crossroads in everybody's life.
Yes.
And my first crossroad came around in when my father died in 1956, and some of his friends insisted that he should be given the honor of, his ashes should be taken to India and immersed there with honor and dignity and so on.
Yeah.
My mother, because of our financial condition, wasn't very keen on doing this immediately. She said she would keep his ashes, and whenever we went to India, she would take them and have them immersed.
Yeah.
But these friends were insistent that it should happen immediately, not wait, we should not wait. And so they agreed to pay for my travel to India and perform these last rites.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I happened to go to India. And having gone to India, I took the opportunity to stay there a little longer to meet with the family and discuss with them my future. And in the meantime, I had a severe attack of appendicitis and had to be operated. And that's where I met my wife. She was my nurse and fell in love and decided to marry her.
And you wouldn't think that appendicitis would lead to something like that.
Right. And there, then I was faced with the problem because the South African government said that I can come back alone, but not with her. They were not willing to give her an entry visa. And so, I wasn't going to leave her and walk away. So I decided to give up South Africa and live in India. And so that was the first turn in my life, a major turn. And then living in India, where I had to find a job and earn money and raise a family and so on. And so that took me in another direction. And then I saw the problems of the untouchables, the low caste people, who were being oppressed in India in the same way that I was oppressed in South Africa. And so I decided with my wife and some friends to get involved in trying to solve this problem. And
it's a big problem, though.
Sorry?
It's a big problem.
It's a big problem, yeah. But we decided to do whatever we could to bring about a change.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, on a small scale, we started programs which are now going on their own momentum.
Yes, I believe everything takes on a life of its own once you put energy into it.
Yeah, it again depends. You see, if you empower the people, a lot of times we do charity, but we don't empower the people, and so the people, they struggle and are not able to stand on their own feet, and so we have to feed charity, all the time.
Yeah, they don't know how to take care of themselves.
What we did with them was we decided that we were not going to give them charity in that sense, but that we were going to make them work for everything that they needed.
Yeah.
First of all, we had to establish them economically before we could talk to them about culture and other things, because they came from such tremendous poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So we started economic programs. We empowered them. We rebuilt their self-respect and self-confidence and trained them. And so once they became, trained and confident in taking care of their affairs, we handed over everything to them, and they then started working on their own,
mm-hmm.
and we were relieved of the responsibility.
Well,
so, now they are expanding on their own.
Why did you decide to come to the United States?
Hmm?
Whenever you first came here and decided to set up your organization.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to come here?
Well, that was the second turn in my life. The second
crossroads
that I came to.
Oh, okay. You had been here before?
No, I had never been here before.
Oh, okay.
As I said, we were working in India and we had these programs going and those programs received some wide publicity and a lot of friends in foreign countries came to know about it. And so we started getting visitors from the United States.
Uh-huh.
And we had one visitor from Vicksburg in Mississippi. And she came and she wanted to see our program and after showing her everything, she invited Sunanda and me to come and have dinner with her at her hotel.
Yeah.
And there we were chatting over dinner and talking about discrimination and so on. And it suddenly came into my mind, even as we were talking, that one should do a study, a comparative study of the three types of prejudices that I had suffered, the color prejudice in South Africa, the caste prejudice in India, and the race prejudice in the United States.
They all kind of have a similar...
foundation.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the word. They all were similar in many ways.
Yeah. And so I just, gave expression to my thoughts. And I said, wouldn't it be fascinating to do this kind of study? And she said, well, would you like to do it? I said, yes, I would like to do it, but I don't have the money to come to the United States and do this study. And we left it at that, and she went back, and then some months later, I got a letter from the University of Mississippi offering me a fellowship to come there and do this study.
Mm.
And then we came here in 1984, accepting that fellowship. But before we landed here, President Reagan had cut all the educational funds, and my fellowship went along with that.
Oh.
And so I was told that I didn't have a fellowship and that, I had to go back again. And so I went back, and that was a tremendous blow because I had invested everything I had in buying the tickets for Sunanda and me to come here.
Oh.
And so I had left my job and everything and... So I had to go back and, start all over again.
Mm.
And I thought, that was going to be a big setback. But, in about a year and a half later, it was in 87, 3 years later,
mm-hmm.
I got a letter from the University of Mississippi again saying that the fellowship was reinstated and that we could come.
But I think you've been a little bit afraid to trust them after the first time.
Yeah. So then I told them, I said, you better send me the ticket money because I'm not going to pay out of my pocket for it.
Yeah.
And so they sent the tickets and that's how we came here. And well, when I came and there was a lot of press publicity, locally, people came to know about me and my connection with Gandhi and so on. And so people just started inviting me to come and speak about him and about his philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that there was a lot of interest in this philosophy and in his life. So why not start an institute and teach? And so we did started that and started teaching this.
Is that when you started your nonviolence association, or did it happen after you got to Memphis? You have a Gandhi Foundation?
That was after I came to Memphis.
Yeah, that's okay. But in those early days in Mississippi, you didn't have a foundation.
No, in the early days I didn't have. You know, it came about only in 19... I started thinking about it in the end of 1988.
Yeah.
And then it took me some time to plan and talk to people, and then I found many roadblocks, and I had to overcome those blocks, and then find the funding for it. And then, you know, by 91, mid-91... June of 91, we had some money, and the Christian Brothers University offered us hospitality, and things kind of fell into place, and it
mm-hmm.
became possible to start the institute.
And that's where your the Gandhi Foundation for Nonviolence is headquarters now, there at the Christian University, isn't it? Christian
right.
Brothers University.
They gave us hospitality. But we were independent, so we had to work and find our own funding and do our own programs and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, their contribution of giving us a home to live in and office on the campus was a major contribution.
Mm-hmm. And then, do you want to tell people what the foundation is?
It's a kind of informal teaching foundation. I thought that I need to share with the rest of the world the lessons that I learned from grandfather and hopefully help them understand, you know, how to deal with the problems in life.
Yeah.
So this was, initially I wanted it to be a regular teaching establishment where we would offer courses in nonviolence. But the university wouldn't allow me to teach because I don't have a doctorate, and so we had to decide to teach informally.
Uh-huh.
And through seminars, workshops, lectures, conferences, and so on. And I think in a way it worked out better this way, because this way I was able to reach out to many more people than I would have been if I had a credit course.
Yes,
this way I would have the freedom
to go where you wanted to go.
Yeah.
Where you were invited to go.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a credit course, then I would be restricted only to the students who signed up for it.
Oh, that's true.
But this way now I can go everywhere and
talk. You do travel all over the world.
Oh, yes, I do. It's become so much now that I have to turn down many invitations.
Yes,
and
because I know I travel too, and after a while those long plane trips, they get to be very difficult.
Oh, yes, they do.
I think you told me one time, didn't you go to Yugoslavia and those areas right when they were the fighting was first starting? Was that correct back in...
No, I went to Lithuania.
Okay, I thought there were some places that where the fighting was going on that you had gone there.
Was after the Soviet Union broke up.
Uh-huh.
There was no fighting, but...
I thought it was somewhere where they were having the violence was happening at that time.
No.
Okay,
no,
I must
that was in
that.
Palestine, where I went in 2004.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, that continuous fighting there between...
Because I think it's very difficult to go somewhere where the violence is occurring and they try to talk about non-violence.
Mm.
You know? Hmm. But anyway, right now you are still traveling and trying to spread this information.
Yes, it is. I think, there's something that I'm doing right, and people are very impressed, and so there are many, many invitations coming for me to go and speak and conduct workshops, and so it's, in a way, it's very encouraging.
And you do speak at a lot of colleges, too, don't you?
I do. I do a lot of work with young people, and that's very encouraging. But,
you do accept donations and things to the foundation, don't you?
Yes, I do. We have various categories of donations. We have a website, GandhiInstitute.org.
Did you say that again?
GandhiInstitute.org.
They go on that website, GandhiInstitute.org. They'll find everything about your foundation and everything.
Right. They can learn everything about it, and they can also make donations or buy books or whatever.
Uh-huh. Okay. And you have written some other books, too. So.
Yes, I have. The most recent has been The Legacy of Love, which is... all the lessons that I learned from Grandfather, which taught me his philosophy of nonviolence.
So you are still doing a lot of work, very active.
Yes. Yes, I am.
It's just the overseas flight that you're not as anxious to do anymore. Well, that's why I'm really glad that you are coming down to Arkansas for our conference next week.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
And you'll be doing a two-hour talk, and you said it's going to be on the topic of what you learned from your grandfather?
Right.
It's probably based on that book, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll be based on the book Legacy of Love.
Uh-huh.
And it's all about what he taught me and how it has affected my life. And especially what he really meant by the philosophy of nonviolence.
Uh-huh.
And I found over the years that people have a very limited understanding of that philosophy, and you generally think that it's about pacifism, and it's about not using physical force and not fighting and so on, and that's only a small part of it.
Oh.
What his philosophy was, it's about relationships with each other,
mm-hmm.
And many other aspects that we need to understand. You know, we kind of concentrate on resolving conflicts, and the tragedy is that we wait for a conflict to occur and then we try to find a solution to that conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But we have seldom, if ever, paid any attention to why did that conflict take place, and how can we avoid such conflicts in the future?
Yes, to stop it before it happens.
Yeah. And so I think the time has come when we need to pay more attention to why do we have to face all these conflicts in
an
advanced
society. To try to stop it before it happens.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I'm watching the clock because I have to stop at 5 minutes before the hour,
mm-hmm.
so they'll be having commercials and things later when this call goes syndicated.
Right.
But I do want to remind people again that Arun will be speaking at the conference here in Fayetteville, Arkansas, next week, June 3rd and 4th. It's called the Transformation Conference. And if you want to know more information about the conference, go on my website. My company is Ozark Mountain Publishing, but on the website it's abbreviated, OZARKMT.com, OzarkMountain.com, MT. Or you can call our 800 number, 1-800-935-0045. 1-800-935-0045 to find out more about the books and about the conference and all the other speakers. And Arun, I want to thank you very much for coming on tonight.
Oh, I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity to take my message to so many people around the world.
This goes all over the world, and it also goes into the archives.
Wonderful.
And they say anyone can download these shows out of the archives free.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And they're telling me, the people that are emailing me said they are downloading these everywhere, and they play them in their cars. So it's reaching a lot of people that we never think it would.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very good. All right, but anyway, I want to thank you again and wish you good night. And I'll
thank
see you.
You
next week.
Okay, thank you very much, and good night to you too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.